ended, and the water, now retired within its proper limits and again spanned gracefully, makes a figure in the prospect from the house. The clear cold sunshine glances into the brittle woods and approvingly beholds the sharp wind scattering the leaves and drying the moss. It glides over the park after the moving shadows of the clouds and chases them and never catches them all day. It looks in at the windows and touches the ancestral portraits with bars and patches of brightness never contemplated by the painters. Athwart the picture of my lady, over the great chimney-piece, it throws a broad bend sinister of light that strikes down crookedly into the hearth and seems to rend it. Through the same cold sunshine and the same sharp wind, my lady and Sir Leicester, in their travelling chariot, my lady's woman and Sir Leicester's man, affectionate in the rumble, start for home. With a considerable amount of jingling and whip-cracking, and many plunging demonstrations on the part of two bare-backed horses and two centaurs with glazed hats, jack-boots, and flowing manes and tails, they rattle out of the yard of the Hôtel Bristol in the Place Vendôme, and canter between the sun and shadow-checkered colonnade of the Rue de Rivoli, and the garden of the ill-fated palace of a headless king and queen, off by the Place of Concorde, and the Elysian fields, and the Gate of the Star, out of Paris. Sooth to say, they cannot go away too fast, for even here my Lady Dedlock has been bored to death. Concert, assembly, opera, theatre, drive, nothing is new to my lady under the worn-out heavens. Only last Sunday, when poor wretches were gay, within the walls playing with children among the clipped trees, and the statues in the palace garden, walking a score abreast in the Elysian fields, made more Elysian by performing dogs and wooden horses, between whiles filtering a few through the gloomy cathedral of Our Lady to say a word or two at the base of a pillar within flare of a rusty little gridiron full of gusty little tapers, without the walls encompassing Paris with dancing, love-making, wine-drinking, tobacco-smoking, tomb-visiting, billiard-card and domino-playing, quack-doctoring and much murderous refuse, animate and inanimate. Only last Sunday, my lady, in the desolation of boredom and the clutch of giant despair, almost hated her own maid for being in spirits. She cannot, therefore, go too fast from Paris. Weariness of soul lies before her, as it lies behind. Her Ariel has put a girdle of it round the whole earth, and it cannot be unclasped. But the imperfect remedy is always to fly from the last place where it has been experienced. Fling Paris back into the distance, then, exchanging it for endless avenues and cross-avenues of wintry trees. And, when next beheld, let it be some leagues away, with the Gate of the Star, a white speck glittering in the sun, and the city a mere mound in a plain, two dark square towers rising out of it, and light and shadow descending on it aslant, like the angels in Jacob's dream. Sir Leicester is generally in a complacent state, and rarely bored. When he has nothing else to do, he can always contemplate his own greatness. It is a considerable advantage to a man to have so inexhaustible a subject. After reading his letters, he leans back in his corner of the carriage and generally reviews his importance to society.
"You have an unusual amount of correspondence this morning," says my lady after a long time. She is fatigued with reading, has almost read a page in 20 miles.
"Nothing in it, though. Nothing whatever."
"I saw one of Mr. Tulkinghorn's long effusions, I think."
"You see everything," says Sir Leicester with admiration.
"Ha!" sighs my lady. "He is the most tiresome of men."
"He sends, I really beg your pardon, he sends," says Sir Leicester, selecting the letter and unfolding it, "a message to you. Our stopping to change horses as I came to his postscript drove it out of my memory. I beg you'll excuse me. He says—"
Sir Leicester is so long in taking out his eyeglass and adjusting it that my lady looks a little irritated.
"He says, in the manner of the right of way—I beg your pardon, that's not the place— He says, yes, here I have it. He says, 'I beg my respectful compliments to my lady, who I hope has benefited by the change. Will you do me the favour to mention, as it may interest her, that I have something to tell her on her return, in reference to the person who copied the affidavit in the Chancery suit, which so powerfully stimulated her curiosity. I have seen him.'"
My lady, leaning forward, looks out of her window.
"That's the message," observes Sir Leicester.
"I should like to walk a little,"
says my lady, still looking out of her window.
Walk? Repeats Sir Leicester, in a tone of surprise.
I should like to walk a little, says my lady with unmistakable distinctness. Please to stop the carriage. The carriage is stopped. The affectionate man alights from the rumble, opens the door, and lets down the steps, obedient to an impatient motion of my lady's hand. My lady alights so quickly, and walks away so quickly, that Sir Leicester, for all his scrupulous politeness, is unable to assist her, and is left behind. A space of a minute or two has elapsed before he comes up with her. She smiles, looks very handsome, takes his arm, lounges with him for a quarter of a mile, is very much bored, and resumes her seat in the carriage. The rattle and clatter continue through the greater part of 3 days, with more or less of bell jingling and whip cracking, and more or less plunging of centaurs and bare-backed horses. Their courtly politeness to each other at the hotels where they tarry is the theme of general admiration. Though my lord is a little aged for my lady, says Madame, the hostess of the Golden Ape, and though he might be her amiable father, one can see at a glance that they love each other. One observes my lord with his white hair standing, hat in hand, to help my lady to and from the carriage. One observes my lady, how recognizant of my lord's politeness, with an inclination of her gracious head and the concession of her so genteel fingers. It is ravishing. The sea has no appreciation of great men, but knocks them about like the small fry. It is habitually hard upon Sir Leicester, whose countenance it greenly mottles in the manner of sage cheese, and in whose aristocratic system it effects a dismal revolution. It is the radical of nature to him. Nevertheless, his dignity gets over it after stopping to refit, and he goes on with my lady for Chesney Wold, lying only one night in London on the way to Lincolnshire. Through the same cold sunlight, colder as the day declines, and through the same sharp wind, sharper as the separate shadows of bare trees gloom together in the woods, and as the ghost's walk, touched at the western corner by a pile of fire in the sky, resigns itself to coming night, they drive into the park. The rooks, swinging in their lofty houses in the elm tree avenue, seem to discuss the question of the occupancy of the carriage as it passes underneath, some agreeing that Sir Leicester and my lady are come down, some arguing with malcontents who won't admit it, now all consenting to consider the question disposed of, now all breaking out again in violent debate, incited by one obstinate and drowsy bird who will persist in putting in a last contradictory croak. Leaving them to swing and caw, the travelling chariot rolls on to the house, where fires gleam warmly through some of the windows, though not through so many as to give an inhabited expression to the darkening mass of front. But the brilliant and distinguished circle will soon do that. Mrs. Rouncewell is in attendance, and receives Sir Leicester's customary shake of the hand with a profound curtsey.
"How do you do, Mrs. Rouncewell? I'm glad to see you."
"I hope I have the honour of welcoming you in good health, Sir Leicester."
"In excellent health, Mrs. Rouncewell."
"My lady is looking charmingly well," says Mrs. Rouncewell, with another curtsey. My lady signifies, without profuse expenditure of words, that she is as wearily well as she can hope to be. But Rosa is in the distance, behind the housekeeper, and my lady, who has not subdued the quickness of her observation, whatever else she may have conquered, asks, "Who is that girl?"
"A young scholar of mine, my lady, Rosa."
"Come here, Rosa."
Lady Dedlock beckons her, with even an appearance of interest.
"Why, do you know how pretty you are, child?" she says, touching her shoulder with her two forefingers.
Rosa, very much abashed, says, "No, if you please, my lady," and glances up and glances down, and don't know where to look, but looks all the prettier.
"How old are you?"
19, my lady."
19, repeats my lady thoughtfully. "Take care they don't spoil you by flattery."
"Yes, my lady." My lady taps her dimpled cheek with the same delicate gloved fingers, and goes on to the foot of the oak staircase where Sir Leicester pauses for her as her knightly escort. A staring old Dedlock in a panel as large as life and as dull looks as if he didn't know what to make of it, which was probably his general state of mind in the days of Queen Elizabeth. That evening, in the housekeeper's room, Rosa can do nothing but murmur Lady Dedlock's praises. She is so affable, so graceful, so beautiful, so elegant, has such a sweet voice and such a thrilling touch that Rosa can feel it yet. Mrs. Rouncewell confirms all this, not without personal pride, reserving only the one point of affability.
Mrs. Rouncewell is not quite sure as to that. Heaven forbid that she should say a syllable in dispraise of any member of that excellent family, above all of my lady, whom the whole world admires. But if my lady would only be a little more free, not quite so cold and distant, Mrs. Rouncewell thinks she would be more affable. "'Tis almost a pity," Mrs. Rouncewell adds, "only almost because it borders on impiety to suppose that anything could be better than it is, in such an express dispensation as the Dedlock affairs, that my lady has no family. If she had had a daughter now, a grown young lady, to interest her, I think she would have had the only kind of excellence she wants." "Might not that have made her still more proud, grandmother?" says Watt, who has been home and come back again, he is such a good grandson. "More and most, my dear," returns the housekeeper with dignity, "are words it's not my place to use, nor so much as to hear, applied to any drawback on my lady." "I beg your pardon, grandmother, but she is proud, is she not?" "If she is, she has reason to be. The Dedlock family have always reason to be." "Well," says Watt, "it's to be hoped they line out of their prayer books a certain passage for the common people about pride and vain glory. Forgive me, grandmother, only a joke."
"Sir Leicester and Lady Dedlock, my dear, are not fit subjects for joking."
"Sir Leicester is no joke by any means," says Watt, "and I humbly ask his pardon. I suppose, grandmother, that even with a family and their guests down here, there is no objection to my prolonging my stay at the Dedlock Arms for a day or two, as any other traveller might?"
"Surely none in the world, child."
"I'm glad of that," says Watt, "because I have an inexpressible desire to extend my knowledge of this beautiful neighbourhood."
He happens to glance at Rosa, who looks down and is very shy indeed, but according to the old superstition, it should be Rosa's ears that burn, and not her fresh, bright cheeks, for my lady's maid is holding forth about her at this moment, with surpassing energy. My lady's maid is a Frenchwoman of 32, from somewhere in the southern country about Avignon and Marseille, a large-eyed brown woman with black hair, who would be handsome but for a certain feline mouth and general uncomfortable tightness of face, rendering the jaws too eager and the skull too prominent. There is something indefinably keen and wan about her anatomy, and she has a watchful way of looking out of the corners of her eyes without turning her head, which could be pleasantly dispensed with, especially when she is in an ill humour and near knives. Through all the good taste of her dress and little adornments, these objections so express themselves that she seemed to go about like a very neat she-wolf imperfectly tamed. Besides being accomplished in all the knowledge appertaining to her post, she is almost an Englishwoman in her acquaintance with the language. Consequently, she is in no want of words to shower upon Rosa for having attracted my lady's attention, and she pours them out with such grim ridicule as she sits at dinner that her companion, the affectionate man, is rather relieved when she arrives at the spoon stage of that performance.
"Ha, ha, ha! She, Hortense, been in my lady's service since 5 years and always kept at the distance, and this doll, this puppet, caressed, absolutely caressed, by my lady on the moment of her arriving at the house? Ha, ha, ha! And do you know how pretty you are, child? No, my lady, you're right there. And how old are you, child? And take care they do not spoil you by flattery, child. Oh, how droll! It is the best thing altogether."
In short, it is such an admirable thing that Mademoiselle Hortense can't forget it. But at meals, for days afterwards, even among her countrywomen and others attached in like capacity to the troop of visitors, relapses into silent enjoyment of the joke, an enjoyment expressed in her own convivial manner by an additional tightness of face, thin elongation of compressed lips, and sidewise look, which intense appreciation of humour is frequently reflected in my lady's mirrors when my lady is not among them. All the mirrors in the house are brought into action now, many of them after a long blank. They reflect handsome faces, simpering faces, youthful faces, faces of 70 that will not submit to be old, the entire collection of faces that have come to pass a January week or two at Chesney Wold, and which the fashionable intelligence, a mighty hunter before the Lord, hunts with a keen scent from their breaking cover at the court of St. James's to their being run down to death. The place in Lincolnshire is all alive. By day guns and voices are heard ringing in the woods. Horsemen and carriages enliven the park roads. Servants and hangers-on pervade the village and the Dedlock Arms. Seen by night from distant openings in the trees, the row of windows in the long drawing-room, where my lady's picture hangs over the great chimney-piece,
is like a row of jewels set in a black frame. On Sunday, the chill little church is almost warmed by so much gallant company, and the general flavour of the Dedlock dust is quenched in delicate perfumes. The brilliant and distinguished circle comprehends within it no contracted amount of education, sense, courage, honour, beauty, and virtue. Yet there is something a little wrong about it, in despite of its immense advantages. What can it be? Dandyism? There is no King George the Fourth now, more the pity, to set the dandy fashion. There are no clear-starched jack-towel neckcloths, no short-waisted coats, no false calves, no stays. There are no caricatures now of effeminate exquisites so arrayed, swooning in opera boxes with excess of delight, and being revived by other dainty creatures poking long-necked scent bottles at their noses. There is no beau whom it takes 4 men at once to shake into his buckskins, or who goes to see all the executions, or who is troubled with the self-reproach of having once consumed a pea. But is there dandyism in the brilliant and distinguished circle notwithstanding, dandyism of a more mischievous sort, that has got below the surface, and is doing less harmless things than jack-toweling itself and stopping its own digestion, to which no rational person need particularly object? Why, yes. It cannot be disguised. There are, at Chesney Wold this January week, some ladies and gentlemen of the newest fashion who have set up a dandyism, in religion, for instance, who in mere lackadaisical want of an emotion have agreed upon a little dandy talk about the vulgar wanting faith in things in general, meaning in the things that have been tried and found wanting, as though a low fellow should unaccountably lose faith in a bad shilling after finding it out, who would make the vulgar very picturesque and faithful by putting back the hands upon the clock of time and cancelling a few 100 years of history. There are also ladies and gentlemen of another fashion, not so new but very elegant, who have agreed to put a smooth glaze on the world and to keep down all its realities, for whom everything must be languid and pretty, who have found out the perpetual stoppage, who are to rejoice at nothing and be sorry for nothing, who are not to be disturbed by ideas, on whom even the fine arts, attending in powder and walking backward like the Lord Chamberlain, must array themselves in the milliner's and tailor's pattern of past generations, and be particularly careful not to be in earnest, or to receive any impress from the moving age. Then there is my Lord Boodle, of considerable reputation with his party, who has known what office is, and who tells Sir Leicester Dedlock with much gravity after dinner, that he really does not see to what the present age is tending. A debate is not what a debate used to be. The House is not what the House used to be. Even a Cabinet is not what it formerly was. He perceives with astonishment that, supposing the present government to be overthrown, the limited choice of the Crown in the formation of a new ministry would lie between Lord Coodle and Sir Thomas Doodle, supposing it to be impossible for the Duke of Foodle to act with Goodle, which may be assumed to be the case, in consequence of the breach arising out of that affair with Hoodle. Then, giving the Home Department and the leadership of the House of Commons to Joodle, the Exchequer to Coodle, the Colonies to Loodle, and the Foreign Office to Moodle, what are you to do with Noodle? You can't offer him the presidency of the Council, that is reserved for Poodle. You can't put him in the woods and forests, that is hardly good enough for Quoodle. What follows? That the country is shipwrecked, lost, and gone to pieces, as is made manifest to the patriotism of Sir Leicester Dedlock, because you can't provide for Noodle. On the other hand, the Right Honourable William Buffy, MP, contends across the table with someone else that the shipwreck of the country, about which there is no doubt, it is only the manner of it that is in question, is attributable to Cuffy. If you had done with Cuffy what you ought to have done when he first came into Parliament, and had prevented him from going over to Duffy, you would have got him into alliance with Fuffy. You would have had with you the weight attaching as a smart debater to Guffy. You would have brought to bear upon the elections the wealth of Huffy. You would have got in for 3 counties, Juffy, Cuffy, and Luffy, and you would have strengthened your administration by the official knowledge in the business habits of Muffy. All this, instead of being, as you now are, dependent on the mere caprice of Puffy. As to this point, and as to some minor topics, there are differences of opinion. But it is perfectly clear to the brilliant and distinguished circle all round that nobody is in question but Boodle and his retinue, and Buffy and his retinue. These are the great actors for whom the stage is reserved. A people there are, no doubt, a certain large number of supernumeraries, who are to be occasionally addressed and relied upon for shouts and choruses, as on the theatrical stage. But Boodle and Buffy, their followers and families, their heirs, executors, administrators, and assigns, are the born first actors, managers, and leaders, and no others can appear upon the scene for ever and ever. In this, too, there is perhaps more dandyism at Chesney Wold than the brilliant and distinguished circle will find good for itself in the long run. For it is, even with the stillest and politest circles, as with the circle the necromancer draws around him, very strange appearances may be seen in active motion outside. With this difference, that being realities and not phantoms, there is the greater danger of their breaking in. Chesney Wold is quite full, anyhow, so full that a burning sense of injury arises in the breasts of ill-lodged ladies' maids, and is not to be extinguished. Only one room is empty. It is a turret chamber of the third order of merit, plainly but comfortably furnished, and having an old-fashioned business air. It is Mr. Tulkinghorn's room, and is never bestowed on anybody else, or he may come at any time. He has not come yet. It is his quiet habit to walk across the park from the village in fine weather, to drop into this room as if he had never been out of it since he was last seen there, to request a servant to inform Sir Leicester that he has arrived, in case he should be wanted, and to appear 10 minutes before dinner in the shadow of the library door. He sleeps in his turret with a complaining flagstaff over his head, and has some leads outside on which, any fine morning when he is down here, his black figure may be seen walking before breakfast like a large species of rook. Every day before dinner my lady looks for him in the dusk of the library, but he is not there. Every day at dinner my lady glances down the table for the vacant place that would be waiting to receive him if he had just arrived, but there is no vacant place. Every night my lady casually asks her maid, "Is Mr. Tulkinghorn come?" Every night the answer is, "No, my lady, not yet." One night, while having her hair undressed, my lady loses herself in deep thought after this reply, until she sees her own brooding face in the opposite glass, and a pair of black eyes curiously observing her. "Be so good as to attend," says my lady then, addressing the reflection of Hortense, "to your business. You can contemplate your beauty at another time." "Pardon, it was your ladyship's beauty." "That," says my lady, "you needn't contemplate at all." At length, one afternoon a little before sunset, when the bright groups of figures which have for the last hour or two enlivened the ghost's walk are all dispersed, and only Sir Leicester and my lady remain upon the terrace, Mr. Tulkinghorn appears. He comes towards them at his usual methodical pace, which is never quickened, never slackened. He wears his usual expressionless mask, if it be a mask, and carries family secrets in every limb of his body and every crease of his dress. Whether his whole soul is devoted to the great, or whether he yields them nothing beyond the services he sells, is his personal secret. He keeps it as he keeps the secrets of his clients. He is his own client in that matter, and will never betray himself.
"How do you do, Mr. Tulkinghorn?" says Sir Leicester, giving him his hand.
Mr. Tulkinghorn is quite well. Sir Leicester is quite well. My lady is quite well. All highly satisfactory. The lawyer, with his hands behind him, walks at Sir Leicester's side along the terrace. My lady walks upon the other side.
"We expected you before,"
says Sir Leicester. A gracious observation. As much as to say,
"Mr. Tulkinghorn, we remember your existence when you are not here to remind us of it by your presence. We bestow a fragment of our minds upon you, sir, you see."
Mr. Tulkinghorn, comprehending it, inclines his head and says he is much obliged.
"I should have come down sooner," he explains, "but that I have been much engaged with those matters in the several suits between yourself and Boythorn." "A man of a very ill-regulated mind," observes Sir Leicester with severity. "An extremely dangerous person in any community. A man of a very low character of mind."
"He is obstinate," says Mr. Tulkinghorn.
"It is natural to such a man to be so," says Sir Leicester, looking most profoundly obstinate himself. "I am not at all surprised to hear it."
"The only question is," pursues the lawyer, "whether you will give up anything."
"No, sir," replies Sir Leicester. "Nothing. I give up."
"I don't mean anything of importance. That, of course, I know you would not abandon. I mean any minor point."
Mr. Tulkinghorn," returned Sir Leicester, "there can be no minor point between myself and Mr. Boythorn. If I go farther and observe that I cannot readily conceive how any right of mine can be a minor point, I speak not so much in reference to myself as an individual, as in reference to the family position I have it in charge to maintain."
Mr. Tulkinghorn inclines his head again. "I have now my instructions," he says. "Mr. Boythorn will give us a good deal of trouble."
"It is the character of such a mind, Mr. Tulkinghorn," Sir Leicester interrupts him, "to give trouble. An exceedingly ill-conditioned, levelling person. A person who, 50 years ago, would probably have been tried at the Old Bailey for some demagogue proceeding, and severely punished. If not," adds Sir Leicester after a moment's pause, "if not hanged, drawn, and quartered."
Sir Leicester appears to discharge his stately breast of a burden in passing this capital sentence, as if it were the next satisfactory thing to have the sentence executed.
"But night is coming on," says he, "and my lady will take cold. My dear, let us go in."
As they turn towards the hall door, Lady Dedlock addresses Mr. Tulkinghorn for the first time. "You sent me a message respecting the person whose writing I happened to inquire about. It was like you to remember the circumstance. I had quite forgotten it. Your message reminded me of it again. I can't imagine what association I had with a hand like that, but I surely had some."
"You had some?" Mr. Tulkinghorn repeats.
"Oh, yes," returns my lady carelessly. "I think I must have had some. And did you really take the trouble to find out the writer of that actual thing? What is it, affidavit?"
"Yes."
"How very odd." They pass into a sombre breakfast-room on the ground floor, lighted in the day by 2 deep windows. It is now twilight. The fire glows brightly on the panelled wall, and palely on the window-glass, where through the cold reflection of the blaze the colder landscape shudders in the wind, and a grey mist creeps along, the only traveller besides the waste of clouds. My lady lounges in a great chair in the chimney corner, and Sir Leicester takes another great chair opposite. The lawyer stands before the fire with his hand out at arm's length, shading his face. He looks across his arm at my lady.
"Yes," he says, "I inquired about the man, and found him. And what is very strange, I found him..."
"Not to be any out-of-the-way person, I'm afraid," Lady Dedlock languidly anticipates.
"I found him dead."
"Oh, dear me,"
remonstrated Sir Leicester, not so much shocked by the fact as by the fact of the fact being mentioned.
"I was directed to his lodging, a miserable, poverty-stricken place, and I found him dead."
"You will excuse me, Mr. Tulkinghorn," observes Sir Leicester. "I think the less said."
"Pray, Sir Leicester, let me hear the story out." It is my lady speaking. "It is quite a story for twilight. How very shocking. Dead?" Mr. Tulkinghorn reasserts it by another inclination of his head.
"Whether by his own hand..."
"Upon my honour," cries Sir Leicester, "really."
"Do let me hear the story," says my lady.
"Whatever you desire, my dear, but I must say..."
"No, you mustn't say. Go on, Mr. Tulkinghorn." Sir Leicester's gallantry concedes the point, though he still feels that to bring this sort of squalor among the upper classes is really... really...
"I was about to say," resumes the lawyer with undisturbed calmness, "that whether he had died by his own hand or not, it was beyond my power to tell you. I should amend that phrase, however, by saying that he had unquestionably died of his own act, though whether by his own deliberate intention or by mischance can never certainly be known. The coroner's jury found that he took the poison accidentally."
"And what kind of man," my lady asks, "was this deplorable creature?"
"Very difficult to say," returns the lawyer, shaking his head. "He had lived so wretchedly and was so neglected with his gypsy colour and his wild black hair and beard that I should have considered him the commonest of the common. The surgeon had a notion that he had once been something better both in appearance and condition."
"What did they call the wretched being?"
"They called him what he had called himself, but no one knew his name."
"Not even anyone who had attended on him?"
"No one had attended on him. He was found dead. In fact, I found him."
"Without any clue to anything more?"
"Without any. There was," said the lawyer meditatively, "an old portmanteau, but no, there were no papers."
During the utterance of every word of this short dialogue, Lady Dedlock and Mr. Tulkinghorn
without any other alteration in their customary deportment, have looked very steadily at one another, as was natural, perhaps, in the discussion of so unusual a subject. Sir Leicester has looked at the fire with the general expression of the Dedlock on the staircase. The story being told, he renews his stately protest, saying that as it is quite clear that no association in my lady's mind can possibly be traceable to this poor wretch, unless he was a begging-letter writer, he trusts to hear no more about a subject so far removed from my lady's station.
"Certainly a collection of horrors," says my lady, gathering up her mantles and furs. "But they interest one for the moment. Have the kindness, Mr. Tulkinghorn, to open the door for me."
Mr. Tulkinghorn does so with deference, and holds it open while she passes out. She passes close to him, with her usual fatigued manner and insolent grace. They meet again at dinner, again next day, again for many days in succession. Lady Dedlock is always the same exhausted deity, surrounded by worshippers, and terribly liable to be bored to death even while presiding at her own shrine. Mr. Tulkinghorn is always the same speechless repository of noble confidences, so oddly out of place and yet so perfectly at home. They appear to take as little note of one another as any two people enclosed within the same walls could. But whether each evermore watches and suspects the other, evermore mistrustful of some great reservation, whether each is evermore prepared at all points for the other and never to be taken unawares, what each would give to know how much the other knows, all this is hidden, for the time, in their own hearts. Chapter 13. Esther's Narrative. We held many consultations about what Richard was to be, first without Mr. Jarndyce, as he had requested, and afterwards with him. But it was a long time before we seemed to make progress. Richard said he was ready for anything. When Mr. Jarndyce doubted whether he might not already be too old to enter the navy, Richard said he had thought of that, and perhaps he was. When Mr. Jarndyce asked him what he thought of the army, Richard said he had thought of that, too, and it wasn't a bad idea. When Mr. Jarndyce advised him to try and decide within himself whether his old preference for the sea was an ordinary boyish inclination or a strong impulse, Richard answered, well, he really had tried very often, and he couldn't make out.
"How much of this indecision of character," Mr. Jarndyce said to me, "is chargeable on that incomprehensible heap of uncertainty and procrastination on which he has been thrown from his birth, I don't pretend to say. But that Chancery, among its other sins, is responsible for some of it, I can plainly see. It has engendered or confirmed in him a habit of putting off and trusting to this, that, and the other chance without knowing what chance, and dismissing everything as unsettled, uncertain, and confused. The character of much older and steadier people may be even changed by the circumstances surrounding them. It would be too much to expect that a boy's, in its formation, should be the subject of such influences and escape them."
I felt this to be true, though if I may venture to mention what I thought besides, I thought it much to be regretted that Richard's education had not counteracted those influences or directed his character. He had been 8 years at a public school, and had learnt, I understood, to make Latin verses of several sorts, in the most admirable manner. But I never heard that it had been anybody's business to find out what his natural bent was, or where his failings lay, or to adapt any kind of knowledge to him. He had been adapted to the verses, and had learnt the art of making them to such perfection that if he had remained at school until he was of age, I suppose he could only have gone on making them over and over again, unless he had enlarged his education by forgetting how to do it. Still, although I had no doubt that they were very beautiful and very improving, and very sufficient for a great many purposes of life, and always remembered all through life, I did doubt whether Richard would not have profited by someone studying him a little, instead of his studying them quite so much. To be sure, I knew nothing of the subject, and do not even now know whether the young gentlemen of classic Rome or Greece made verses to the same extent, or whether the young gentlemen of any country ever did.
"I haven't the least idea," said Richard, musing, "what I had better be. Except that I am quite sure I don't want to go into the church. It's a toss-up." "You have no inclination in Mr. Kenge's way?"
suggested Mr. Jarndyce.
"I don't know that, sir," replied Richard. "I'm fond of boating. Articled clerks go a good deal on the water. It's a capital profession."
"Surgeon?" suggested Mr. Jarndyce.
"That's the thing, sir," cried Richard.
I doubt if he had ever once thought of it before.
"That's the thing, sir," repeated Richard, with the greatest enthusiasm. We have got it at last. MRCS. He was not to be laughed out of it, though he laughed at it heartily. He said he had chosen his profession, and the more he thought of it, the more he felt that his destiny was clear. The art of healing was the art of all others for him. Mistrusting that he only came to this conclusion because, having never had much chance of finding out for himself what he was fitted for, and having never been guided to the discovery, he was taken by the newest idea and was glad to get rid of the trouble of consideration. I wondered whether the Latin verses often ended in this, or whether Richard's was a solitary case. Mr. Jarndyce took great pains to talk with him seriously, and to put it to his good sense not to deceive himself in so important a manner. Richard was a little grave after these interviews, but invariably told Ada and me that it was all right, and then began to talk about something else.
"By heaven!"
cried Mr. Boythorn, who interested himself strongly in the subject, though I need not say that, for he could do nothing weakly.
"I rejoice to find a young gentleman of spirit and gallantry devoting himself to that noble profession. The more spirit there is in it, the better for mankind, and the worse for those mercenary taskmasters and low tricksters who delight in putting that illustrious art at a disadvantage in the world. By all that is base and despicable," cried Mr. Boythorn, "the treatment of surgeons aboard ship is such that I would submit the legs, both legs, of every member of the Admiralty Board to a compound fracture, and render it a transportable offence in any qualified practitioner to set them, if the system were not wholly changed in 48 hours."
"Wouldn't you give them a week?" asked Mr. Jarndyce.
"No," cried Mr. Boythorn firmly. "Not on any consideration. 48 hours. As to corporations, parishes, vestry boards, and similar gatherings of jolter-headed clods who assemble to exchange such speeches that, by heaven, they ought to be working quicksilver mines for the short remainder of their miserable existence, if it were only to prevent their detestable English from contaminating a language spoken in the presence of the sun. As to those fellows who meanly take advantage of the ardour of gentlemen in the pursuit of knowledge to recompense the inestimable services the best years of their lives, their long study and their expensive education, with pittances too small for the acceptance of clerks, I would have the necks of every one of them wrung, and their skulls arranged in surgeons' hall for the contemplation of the whole profession, in order that its younger members might understand from actual measurement in early life how thick skulls may become."
He wound up this vehement declaration by looking round upon us with a most agreeable smile and suddenly thundering, "Ha, ha, ha!" over and over again, until anybody else might have been expected to be quite subdued by the exertion. As Richard still continued to say that he was fixed in his choice, after repeated periods for consideration had been recommended by Mr. Jarndyce and had expired, and he still continued to assure Ada and me in the same final manner that it was all right, it became advisable to take Mr. Kenge into counsel. Mr. Kenge therefore came down to dinner one day, and leaned back in his chair, and turned his eyeglasses over and over, and spoke in a sonorous voice, and did exactly what I remembered to have seen him do when I was a little girl.
"Ah," said Mr. Kenge, "yes. Well, a very good profession, Mr. Jarndyce, a very good profession."
"The course of study and preparation requires to be diligently pursued," observed my guardian, with a glance at Richard.
"Oh, no doubt," said Mr. Kenge, "diligently."
"But that being the case, more or less, with all pursuits that are worth much," said Mr. Jarndyce, "it is not a special consideration which another choice would be likely to escape."
"Truly," said Mr. Kenge, "and Mr. Richard Carstone, who has so meritoriously acquitted himself in the, shall I say, the classic shades, in which his youth had been passed, will no doubt apply the habits, if not the principles and practice, of versification in that tongue in which a poet was said, unless I mistake, to be born, not made, to the more eminently practical field of action on which he enters."
"You may rely upon it," said Richard in his off-hand manner, "that I shall go at it and do my best."
"Very well, Mr. Jarndyce," said Mr. Kenge, gently nodding his head. "Really, when we are assured by Mr. Richard that he means to go at it and do his best," nodding feelingly and smoothly over those expressions, "I would submit to you that we have only to inquire into the best mode of carrying out the object of his ambition. Now, with reference to placing Mr. Richard with some sufficiently eminent practitioner, is there anyone in view at present?"
"No one, Rick, I think," said my guardian.
"No one, sir," said Richard. "Quite so," observed Mr. Kenge. "As to situation, now, is there any particular feeling on that head?"
"No," said Richard.
"Quite so," observed Mr. Kenge again. "I should like a little variety," said Richard. "I mean a good range of experience."
"Very requisite, no doubt," returned Mr. Kenge. "I think this may be easily arranged, Mr. Jarndyce. We have only, in the first place, to discover a sufficiently eligible practitioner, and as soon as we make our want, and, shall I add, our ability to pay a premium, known, our only difficulty will be in the selection of one from a large number. We have only, in the second place, to observe those little formalities which are rendered necessary by our time of life and our being under the guardianship of the court. We shall soon be, shall I say, in Mr. Richard's own light-hearted manner, going at it to our heart's content. It is a coincidence," said Mr. Kenge, with a tinge of melancholy in his smile, "one of those coincidences which may or may not require an explanation beyond our present limited faculties, that I have a cousin in the medical profession. He might be deemed eligible by you, and might be disposed to respond to this proposal. I can answer for him as little as for you, but he might." As this was an opening in the prospect, it was arranged that Mr. Kenge should see his cousin. And as Mr. Jarndyce had before proposed to take us to London for a few weeks, it was settled next day that we should make our visit at once, and combine Richard's business with it. Mr. Boythorn leaving us within a week, we took up our abode at a cheerful lodging near Oxford Street over an upholsterer's shop. London was a great wonder to us, and we were out for hours and hours at a time seeing the sights, which appeared to be less capable of exhaustion than we were. We made the round of the principal theatres, too, with great delight, and saw all the plays that were worth seeing. I mention this because it was at the theatre that I began to be made uncomfortable again by Mr. Guppy. I was sitting in front of the box one night with Ada, and Richard was in the place he liked best, behind Ada's chair, when, happening to look down into the pit, I saw Mr. Guppy, with his hair flattened down upon his head and woe depicted in his face, looking up at me. I felt all through the performance that he never looked at the actors, but constantly looked at me, and always with a carefully prepared expression of the deepest misery and the profoundest dejection. It quite spoiled my pleasure for that night, because it was so very embarrassing, and so very ridiculous. But from that time forth, we never went to the play without my seeing Mr. Guppy in the pit, always with his hair straight and flat, his shirt-collar turned down, and a general feebleness about him. If he were not there when we went in, and I began to hope he would not come, and yielded myself for a little while to the interest of the scene, I was certain to encounter his languishing eyes when I least expected it, and, from that time, to be quite sure that they were fixed upon me all the evening. I really cannot express how uneasy this made me. If he would only have brushed up his hair or turned up his collar, it would have been bad enough, but to know that that absurd figure was always gazing at me, and always in that demonstrative state of despondency, put such a constraint upon me that I did not like to laugh at the play, or to cry at it, or to move, or to speak. I seemed able to do nothing naturally. As to escaping Mr. Guppy by going to the back of the box, I could not bear to do that, because I knew Richard and Ada relied on having me next them, and that they could never have talked together so happily if anybody else had been in my place. So there I sat, not knowing where to look, for wherever I looked I knew Mr. Guppy's eyes were following me, and thinking of the dreadful expense to which this young man was putting himself on my account. Sometimes I thought of telling Mr. Jarndyce. Then I feared that the young man would lose his situation, and that I might ruin him. Sometimes I thought of confiding in Richard, but was deterred by the possibility of his fighting Mr. Guppy and giving him black eyes. Sometimes I thought, should I frown at him, or shake my head? Then I felt I could not do it. Sometimes I considered whether I should write to his mother, but that ended in my being convinced that to open a correspondence would be to make the matter worse. I always came to the conclusion, finally, that I could do nothing. Mr. Guppy's perseverance all this time not only produced him regularly at any theatre to which we went, but caused him to appear in the crowd as we were coming out, and even to get up behind our fly, where I am sure I saw him two or three times, struggling among the most dreadful spikes. After we got home, he haunted a post opposite our house, the upholsterer's where we lodged being at the corner of two streets, and my bedroom window being opposite the post. I was afraid to go near the window when I went upstairs, lest I should see him, as I did one moonlight night, leaning against the post and evidently catching cold. If Mr. Guppy had not been, fortunately for me, engaged in the daytime, I really should have had no rest from him.
While we were making this round of gaieties in which Mr. Guppy so extraordinarily participated, the business which had helped to bring us to town was not neglected. Mr. Kenge's cousin was a Mr. Bayham Badger, who had a good practice at Chelsea, and attended a large public institution besides. He was quite willing to receive Richard into his house, and to superintend his studies, and as it seemed that those could be pursued advantageously under Mr. Badger's roof, and Mr. Badger liked Richard, and as Richard said he liked Mr. Badger well enough, an agreement was made, the Lord Chancellor's consent was obtained, and it was all settled. On the day when matters were concluded between Richard and Mr. Badger, we were all under engagement to dine at Mr. Badger's house. We were to be merely a family party, Mrs. Badger's note said, and we found no lady there but Mrs. Badger herself. She was surrounded in the drawing-room by various objects, indicative of her painting a little, playing the piano a little, playing the guitar a little, playing the harp a little, singing a little, working a little, reading a little, writing poetry a little, and botanizing a little. She was a lady of about 50, I should think, youthfully dressed, and of a very fine complexion. If I add to the little list of her accomplishments that she rouged a little, I do not mean that there was any harm in it. Mr. Bayham Badger himself was a pink, fresh-faced, crisp-looking gentleman with a weak voice, white teeth, light hair, and surprised eyes, some years younger, I should say, than Mrs. Bayham Badger. He admired her exceedingly, but principally, and to begin with, on the curious ground, as it seemed to us, of her having had three husbands. We had barely taken our seats when he said to Mr. Jarndyce quite triumphantly, "You would hardly suppose that I am Mrs. Bayham Badger's third."
"Indeed?"
said Mr. Jarndyce.
"Her third," said Mr. Badger.
"Mrs. Bayham Badger has not the appearance, Miss Summerson, of a lady who has had two former husbands." I said, "Not at all." "And most remarkable men," said Mr. Badger in a tone of confidence. "Captain Swosser of the Royal Navy, who was Mrs. Badger's first husband, was a very distinguished officer indeed. The name of Professor Dingo, my immediate predecessor, is one of European reputation." Mrs. Badger overheard him and smiled. "Yes, my dear," Mr. Badger replied to the smile. "I was observing to Mr. Jarndyce and Miss Summerson that you had had two former husbands, both very distinguished men, and they found it, as people generally do, difficult to believe."
"I was barely 20," said Mrs. Badger, "when I married Captain Swosser of the Royal Navy. I was in the Mediterranean with him. I'm quite a sailor. On the 12th anniversary of my wedding day, I became the wife of Professor Dingo."
"Of European reputation," added Mr. Badger in an undertone.
"And when Mr. Badger and myself were married," pursued Mrs. Badger, "we were married on the same day of the year. I had become attached to the day."
"So that Mrs. Badger has been married to three husbands, two of them highly distinguished men," said Mr. Badger, summing up the facts, "and each time upon the 21st of March at 11 in the forenoon." We all expressed our admiration.
"But for Mr. Badger's modesty," said Mr. Jarndyce, "I would take leave to correct him and say three distinguished men."
"Thank you, Mr. Jarndyce, what I always tell him," observed Mrs. Badger.
"And my dear," said Mr. Badger, "what do I always tell you? That without any affectation of disparaging such professional distinction as I may have attained, which our friend Mr. Carstone will have many opportunities of estimating, I am not so weak, no, really," said Mr. Badger to us generally, "so unreasonable as to put my reputation on the same footing with such first-rate men as Captain Swosser and Professor Dingo. Perhaps you may be interested, Mr. Jarndyce," continued Mr. Bayham Badger, leading the way into the next drawing-room, "in this portrait of Captain Swosser. It was taken on his return home from the African station, where he had suffered from the fever of the country. Mrs. Badger considers it too yellow, but it's a very fine head, a very fine head." We all echoed, "A very fine head." "I feel when I look at it," said Mr. Badger, "that's a man I should like to have seen. It strikingly bespeaks the first-class man that Captain Swosser pre-eminently was. On the other side, Professor Dingo, I knew him well, attended him in his last illness, a speaking likeness. Over the piano, Mrs. Bayham Badger when Mrs. Swosser. Over the sofa, Mrs. Bayham Badger when Mrs. Dingo. Of Mrs. Bayham Badger in esse, I possess the original and have no copy." Dinner was now announced, and we went downstairs. It was a very genteel entertainment, very handsomely served. But the captain and the professor still ran in Mr. Badger's head, and as Ada and I had the honour of being under his particular care, we had the full benefit of them. "What are Miss Summerson?"
"'Allow me. Not in that tumbler, pray. Bring me the Professor's goblet, James.'
Ada very much admired some artificial flowers under a glass.
"'Astonishing how they keep,' said Mr. Badger. "'They were presented to Mrs. Bayham Badger when she was in the Mediterranean.'
He invited Mr. Jarndyce to take a glass of claret.
"'Not that claret,' he said. "'Excuse me, this is an occasion, and on an occasion I produce some very special claret I happen to have. James, Captain Swosser's wine.' "'Mr. Jarndyce, this is a wine that was imported by the captain, we will not say how many years ago. You will find it very curious. My dear, I shall be happy to take some of this wine with you. Captain Swosser's claret to your mistress, James. My love, your health.'
After dinner, when we ladies retired, we took Mrs. Badger's first and second husband with us. Mrs. Badger gave us in the drawing-room a biographical sketch of the life and services of Captain Swosser before his marriage, and a more minute account of him dating from the time when he fell in love with her at a ball on board the Crippler, given to the officers of that ship when she lay in Plymouth Harbour.
"'The dear old Crippler,' said Mrs. Badger, shaking her head. "'She was a noble vessel, trim, shipshape, all a taunto, as Captain Swosser used to say. You must excuse me if I occasionally introduce a nautical expression. I was quite a sailor once.' Captain Swosser loved that craft for my sake. When she was no longer in commission, he frequently said that if he were rich enough to buy her old hulk, he would have an inscription let into the timbers of the quarter-deck where we stood as partners in the dance to mark the spot where he fell, raked fore and aft, Captain Swosser used to say, by the fire from my tops. It was his naval way of mentioning my eyes.
Mrs. Badger shook her head, sighed, and looked in the glass.
"'It was a great change from Captain Swosser to Professor Dingo,' she resumed with a plaintive smile. "'I felt it a good deal at first. Such an entire revolution in my mode of life. But custom, combined with science, particularly science, inured me to it. Being the Professor's sole companion in his botanical excursions, I almost forgot that I had ever been afloat, and became quite learned.' It is singular that the Professor was the antipodes of Captain Swosser, and that Mr. Badger is not in the least like either.
We then passed into a narrative of the deaths of Captain Swosser and Professor Dingo, both of whom seemed to have had very bad complaints. In the course of it, Mrs. Badger signified to us that she had never madly loved but once, and that the object of that wild affection, never to be recalled in its fresh enthusiasm, was Captain Swosser. The Professor was yet dying by inches in the most dismal manner, and Mrs. Badger was giving us imitations of his way of saying, with great difficulty,
"'Where is Laura? Let Laura give me my toast and water,'
when the entrance of the gentleman consigned him to the tomb. Now, I observed that evening, as I had observed for some days past, that Ada and Richard were more than ever attached to each other's society, which was but natural, seeing that they were going to be separated so soon. I was therefore not very much surprised when we got home, and Ada and I retired upstairs, to find Ada more silent than usual, though I was not quite prepared for her coming into my arms and beginning to speak to me, with her face hidden.
"'My darling Esther,' murmured Ada, "'I have a great secret to tell you.'
"'A mighty secret, my pretty one, no doubt. What is it, Ada?'
"'Oh, Esther, you would never guess.'
"'Shall I try to guess?' said I.
"'Oh, no, don't, pray don't,'
cried Ada, very much startled by the idea of my doing so. "'Now, I wonder who it can be about,' said I, pretending to consider.
"'It's about,' said Ada in a whisper. "'It's about my cousin Richard.'
"'Well, my own,' said I, kissing her bright hair, which was all I could see. "'And what about him?'
"'Oh, Esther, you would never guess.'
It was so pretty to have her clinging to me in that way, hiding her face, and to know that she was not crying in sorrow, but in a little glow of joy and pride and hope, that I would not help her just yet.
"'He says... I know it's very foolish, we are both so young, but he says,'
with a burst of tears,
"'that he loves me dearly, Esther.'
"'Does he indeed?' said I. "'I never heard of such a thing. Why, my pet of pets, I could have told you that weeks and weeks ago.' To see Ada lift up her flushed face in joyful surprise, and hold me round the neck, and laugh, and cry, and blush, was so pleasant. "'Why, my darling,' said I, "'what a goose you must take me for! Your cousin Richard has been loving you as plainly as he could for I don't know how long.'
"'And yet you never said a word about it,' cried Ada, kissing me.
"'No, my love,' said I, "'I waited to be told.'
"'But now I have told you. You don't think it wrong of me, do you?'
returned Ada. She might have coaxed me to say no if I had been the hardest-hearted duenna in the world. Not being that yet, I said no very freely. "And now," said I know the worst of it. "Oh, that's not quite the worst of it, Esther dear," cried Ada, holding me tighter and laying down her face again upon my breast. "No," said I, "not even that." "No, not even that," said Ada, shaking her head. "Why, you never mean to say," I was beginning in joke. But Ada, looking up and smiling through her tears, cried, "Yes, I do. You know I do." And then sobbed out, "With all my heart I do, with all my whole heart, Esther." I told her, laughing, why I had known that, too, just as well as I had known the other. And we sat before the fire, and I had all the talking to myself for a little while, though there was not much of it, and Ada was soon quiet and happy. "Do you think my cousin John knows, dear Dame Durden?" she asked. "Unless my cousin John is blind, my pet," said I should think my cousin John knows pretty well as much as we know." "We want to speak to him before Richard goes," said Ada timidly, "and we wanted you to advise us, and to tell him so. Perhaps you wouldn't mind Richard's coming in, Dame Durden?" "Oh, Richard is outside, is he, my dear?" said I. "I'm not quite certain," returned Ada with a bashful simplicity that would have won my heart if she had not won it long before, "but I think he's waiting at the door." There he was, of course. They brought a chair on either side of me and put me between them, and really seemed to have fallen in love with me instead of one another, they were so confiding and so trustful and so fond of me. They went on in their own wild way for a little while. I never stopped them. I enjoyed it too much myself. And then we gradually fell to considering how young they were, and how there must be a lapse of several years before this early love could come to anything, and how it could come to happiness only if it were real and lasting, and inspired them with a steady resolution to do their duty to each other with constancy, fortitude, and perseverance, each always for the other's sake. Well, Richard said that he would work his fingers to the bone for Ada, and Ada said that she would work her fingers to the bone for Richard, and they called me all sorts of endearing and sensible names, and we sat there advising and talking half the night. Finally, before we parted, I gave them my promise to speak to their cousin John tomorrow. So when tomorrow came, I went to my guardian after breakfast, in the room that was our town substitute for the growlery, and told him that I had it in trust to tell him something. "Well, little woman," said he, shutting up his book, "if you have accepted the trust, there can be no harm in it."
"I hope not, guardian," said I. "I can guarantee that there is no secrecy in it, for it only happened yesterday."
"Aye, and what is it, Esther?"
"Guardian," said I, "you remember the happy night when first we came down to Bleak House, when Ada was singing in the dark room?" I wished to call to his remembrance the look he had given me then. Unless I am much mistaken, I saw that I did so.
"Because," said I with a little hesitation.
"Yes, my dear," said he, "don't hurry."
"Because," said I, "Ada and Richard have fallen in love, and have told each other so."
"Already?" cried my guardian, quite astonished.
"Yes," said I, "and to tell you the truth, guardian, I rather expected it."
"The deuce you did," said he.
He sat considering for a minute or two, with his smile, at once so handsome and so kind, upon his changing face, and then requested me to let them know that he wished to see them. When they came, he encircled Ada with one arm in his fatherly way, and addressed himself to Richard with a cheerful gravity.
"Rick," said Mr. Jarndyce, "I'm glad to have won your confidence. I hope to preserve it. When I contemplated these relations between us four, which have so brightened my life, and so invested it with new interests and pleasures, I certainly did contemplate, afar off, the possibility of you and your pretty cousin here—don't be shy, Ada, don't be shy, my dear— being in a mind to go through life together. I saw and do see many reasons to make it desirable, but that was afar off, Rick, afar off."
"We look afar off, sir," returned Richard.
"Well," said Mr. Jarndyce, "that's rational. Now hear me, my dears. I might tell you that you don't know your own minds yet, that a thousand things may happen to divert you from one another, that it is well this chain of flowers you have taken up is very easily broken, or it might become a chain of lead. But I will not do that. Such wisdom will come soon enough, I dare say, if it is to come at all. I will assume that a few years hence you will be in your hearts to one another what you are today. All I say before speaking to you according to that assumption is, if you do change, if you do come to find that you are more commonplace cousins to each other as man and woman than you were as boy and girl, your manhood will excuse me, Rick, don't be ashamed still to confide in me, for there will be nothing monstrous or uncommon in it. I am only your friend and distant kinsman. I have no power over you whatever, but I wish and hope to retain your confidence, if I do nothing to forfeit it.
I am very sure, sir, returned Richard, that I speak for Ada too, when I say that you have the strongest power over us both, rooted in respect, gratitude, and affection, strengthening every day.
Dear cousin John, said Ada on his shoulder, my father's place can never be empty again. All the love and duty I could ever have rendered to him is transferred to you.
Come, said Mr. Jarndyce, now for our assumption. Now we lift our eyes up and look hopefully at the distance. Rick, the world is before you, and it is most probable that as you enter it, so it will receive you. Trust in nothing but in Providence and your own efforts. Never separate the two like the heathen wagoner. Constancy in love is a good thing, but it means nothing and is nothing without constancy in every kind of effort. If you had the abilities of all the great men past and present, you could do nothing well without sincerely meaning it and setting about it. If you entertain the supposition that any real success, in great things or in small, ever was or could be, ever will or can be, wrested from fortune by fits and starts, leave that wrong idea here, or leave your cousin Ada here.
I will leave it here, sir, replied Richard, smiling, if I brought it here just now, but I hope I did not, and will work my way on to my cousin Ada in the hopeful distance.
Right, said Mr. Jarndyce. If you are not to make her happy, why should you pursue her?
I wouldn't make her unhappy, no, not even for her love, retorted Richard proudly.
Well said, cried Mr. Jarndyce. That's well said. She remains here in her home with me. Love her, Rick, in your active life, no less than in her home when you revisit it, and all will go well. Otherwise, all will go ill. That's the end of my preaching. I think you and Ada had better take a walk.
Ada tenderly embraced him, and Richard heartily shook hands with him, and then the cousins went out of the room, looking back again directly, though, to say that they would wait for me. The door stood open, and we both followed them with our eyes as they passed down the adjoining room, on which the sun was shining, and out at its farther end. Richard, with his head bent and her hand drawn through his arm, was talking to her very earnestly, and she looked up in his face, listening, and seemed to see nothing else. So young, so beautiful, so full of hope and promise, they went on lightly through the sunlight, as their own happy thoughts might then be traversing the years to come, and making them all years of brightness. So they passed away into the shadow and were gone. It was only a burst of light that had been so radiant. The room darkened as they went out, and the sun was clouded over.
"Am I right, Esther?" said my guardian when they were gone.
He was so good and wise to ask me whether he was right.
"Rick may gain out of this the quality he wants, at the core of so much that is good," said Mr. Jarndyce, shaking his head. "I have said nothing to Ada, Esther. She has her friend and counsellor always near."
And he laid his hand lovingly upon my head. I could not help showing that I was a little moved, though I did all I could to conceal it.
"Tut, tut," said he. "But we must take care, too, that our little woman's life is not all consumed in care for others."
"Care, my dear guardian? I believe I'm the happiest creature in the world."
"I believe so, too," said he. But someone may find out, what Esther never will, that the little woman is to be held in remembrance above all other people.
I have omitted to mention in its place that there was someone else at the family dinner party. It was not a lady, it was a gentleman. It was a gentleman of a dark complexion, a young surgeon. He was rather reserved, but I thought him very sensible and agreeable. At least Ada asked me if I did not, and I said yes. Chapter 14. Deportment. Richard left us on the very next evening to begin his new career, and committed Ada to my charge with great love for her and great trust in me. It touched me then to reflect, and it touches me now more nearly, to remember, having what I have to tell, how they both thought of me, even at that engrossing time. I was a part of all their plans for the present and the future. I was to write Richard once a week, making my faithful report of Ada, who was to write to him every alternate day. I was to be informed under his own hand of all his labours and successes. I was to observe how resolute and persevering he would be. I was to be Ada's bridesmaid when they were married. I was to live with them afterwards. I was to keep all the keys of their house. I was to be made happy for ever and a day. "And if the suit should make us rich, Esther, which it may, you know," said Richard to crown all. A shade crossed Ada's face. "My dearest Ada," asked Richard, "why not?"
"It had better declare us poor at once," said Ada.
"Oh, I don't know about that," returned Richard. "But at all events it won't declare anything at once. It hasn't declared anything in heaven knows how many years."
"Too true," said Ada.
"Yes, but," urged Richard, answering what her look suggested rather than her words, "the longer it goes on, dear cousin, the nearer it must be to a settlement, one way or other. Now is that not reasonable?"
"You know best, Richard. But I'm afraid if we trust to it, it will make us unhappy."
"But, my Ada, we are not going to trust to it," cried Richard gaily. "We know it better than to trust to it. We only say that if it should make us rich, we have no constitutional objection to being rich. The court is, by solemn settlement of law, our grim old guardian, and we are to suppose that what it gives us, when it gives us anything, is our right. It is not necessary to quarrel with our right."
"No," said Ada, "but it may be better to forget all about it."
"Well, well," cried Richard, "then we will forget all about it. We will consign the whole thing to oblivion. Dame Durden puts on her approving face, and it's done."
"Dame Durden's approving face," said I, looking out of the box in which I was packing his books, "was not very visible when you called it by that name. But it does approve, and she thinks you can't do better."
So, Richard said, there was an end of it, and immediately began, on no other foundation, to build as many castles in the air as would man the Great Wall of China. He went away in high spirits. Ada and I, prepared to miss him very much, commenced our quieter career. On our arrival in London, we had called with Mr. Jarndyce at Mrs. Jellyby's, but had not been so fortunate as to find her at home. It appeared that she had gone somewhere to a tea-drinking, and had taken Miss Jellyby with her. Besides the tea-drinking, there was to be some considerable speech-making and letter-writing on the general merits of the cultivation of coffee conjointly with natives at the settlement of Borrioboola-Gha. All this involved, no doubt, sufficient active exercise of pen and ink to make her daughter's part in the proceedings anything but a holiday. It being now beyond the time appointed for Mrs. Jellyby's return, we called again. She was in town, but not at home, having gone to Mile End directly after breakfast on some Borrioboolan business arising out of a society called the East London Branch Aid Ramification. As I had not seen Peepy on the occasion of our last call, when he was not to be found anywhere, and when the cook rather thought he must have strolled away with the dustman's cart, I now inquired for him again. The oyster shells he had been building a house with were still in the passage, but he was nowhere discoverable, and the cook supposed that he had gone after the sheep. When we repeated with some surprise, "The sheep?" she said, "Oh yes, on market days he sometimes followed them quite out of town, and came back in such a state as never was." I was sitting at the window with my guardian on the following morning, and Ada was busy writing, of course to Richard, when Miss Jellyby was announced, and entered, leading the identical Peepy, whom she had made some endeavours to render presentable by wiping the dirt into corners of his face and hands, and making his hair very wet, and then violently frizzing it with her fingers. Everything the dear child wore was either too large for him or too small. Among his other contradictory decorations he had the hat of a bishop, and the little gloves of a baby. His boots were, on a small scale, the boots of a ploughman, while his legs, so crossed and recrossed with scratches that they looked like maps, were bare below a very short pair of plaid drawers, finished off with two frills of perfectly different patterns. The deficient buttons on his plaid frock had evidently been supplied from one of Mr. Jellyby's coats, they were so extremely brazen and so much too large. Most extraordinary specimens of needlework appeared on several parts of his dress, where it had been hastily mended, and I recognised the same hand on Miss Jellyby's. She was, however, unaccountably improved in her appearance, and looked very pretty. She was conscious of poor little Peepy being but a failure after all her trouble, and she showed it as she came in by the way in which she glanced first at him and then at us.
"Oh, dear me," said my guardian. "Due east."
Ada and I gave her a cordial welcome, and presented her to Mr. Jarndyce, to whom she said, as she sat down, "Ma's compliments, and she hopes you'll excuse her, because she's correcting proofs of the plan. She's going to put out 5,000 new circulars, and she knows you'll be interested to hear that. I have brought one of them with me. Ma's compliments." With which she presented it sulkily enough.
"Thank you,"
said my guardian. "I am much obliged to Mrs. Jellyby.
Oh, dear me, this is a very trying wind."
We were busy with Peepy, taking off his clerical hat, asking him if he remembered us, and so on. Peepy retired behind his elbow at first, but relented at the sight of sponge cake, and allowed me to take him on my lap, where he sat, munching quietly. Mr. Jarndyce then withdrawing into the temporary growlery, Miss Jellyby opened a conversation with her